This spring, a series of shootings targeted random drivers on highways in and around Kansas City. A few weeks later, a gunman approached a car at a gas station and fired shots, leaving the driver of the car dead and his young son paralyzed. A 5-year-old boy witnessed the scene. What these crimes have in common, aside from gun violence, is a community response that helped police apprehend suspects. I'm Gina Kaufman. This morning on Central Standard, we'll be joining Chief of Police Daryl Forte for a conversation about how communities organized in response to these events. We'll also invite you to join the conversation. Meet Chief of Police Daryl Forte right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Chief of Police Daryl Forte, a really busy guy who has been trying for weeks to fit us into his schedule. Thanks so much for taking the time to be here today.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Well, Chief Forte, we invited you on our show this morning because recently suspects were apprehended in two high-profile cases, thanks in large part to community-based efforts. That is, people taking it upon themselves to get involved. One case was the highway shootings that lasted through March and early April, and another was a shooting at a gas station where a gunman fired into a car, leaving the driver dead and his young son paralyzed. In both cases, the public rallied, urging witnesses to come forward and share tips.
Yeah, and that's what it's going to take in this community to make it safer. When we have any incident, whether it be something as minor as a burglary or auto theft, we need people to step up. And most of the people in the neighborhood that live in these neighborhoods know what is occurring in these neighborhoods, but they are fearful for a number of reasons, and I understand those reasons. But in order to make our city safe, I think we all have to step up and get involved like they did on these last two incidents.
Well, yeah, that is what we hear so much of the time, that people in the communities where these crimes are occurring know more than they're willing to share for a whole host of reasons, including fear of retaliation. Were these two recent cases as unusual as we might be led to believe?
No, I don't think they were really unusual. We have people that the actual cases weren't unusual when you have someone shooting at people. You know, it was randomly a random act on the highway, of course, the highway shooter. And when you talk about the young man that was shot and killed and his son who was severely injured, that happens all the time in a lot of major cities. But what we need to do here in Kansas City, again, is step up and say no more. And some neighborhoods say that, and they don't have problems on their individual blocks because people on those blocks know that, you know, the residents are not going to tolerate these things.
Can you give us an example of that, a block in Kansas City where people have just transformed the relationship with crime that way?
If you look at a lot of blocks over in Ivanhoe, you know, just for an example, many blocks over there, if you look at a couple of blocks over there east of 33rd and Indiana, if you drive by those houses, the houses are well kept. I drive by there all the time. The lines are manicured. There's one block over there specifically, and I can't think of it, maybe Bell's, but the houses are manicured like they were years ago, and you have very few problems on that block.
So upkeep of like a physical space can really make that big of a difference in terms of violent crime?
I believe so. It makes a huge difference when people know, kind of like when you see a dump site, an illegal dump site, one person dumped something there and go back 4 or 5 days later and there's a mound of trash out there. I bought 5 vacant properties in Kansas City, vacant lands in 2005, just so I can go back and maintain them. And it really came true to me. If someone dumped a load of shingles on your property and I didn't go back and pick them up, the next week or two, there would be trash bags, there'd be sofas and things like that. So that's true. People respect what other people respect.
I want to get back to the line of questioning I was following in just a second, but it seems to me a little unusual for a chief of police to take it upon himself to buy vacant lots and really take this approach personally as an individual on his own. Could you talk a little bit about your relationship with this job?
I did that before I became chief. I believe I maybe was a major then. And I just saw some things that were happening in the neighborhood. And so many people complain about what's occurring in the neighborhood, but so few of us step up to do something. We all know what the problems are. We know there's a whole host of problems out there. But ask ourselves, what are we doing to contribute to reduce the problems out there and to take people by hand? So I just thought during that time, it was a Terry Blair, the serial killer, was out during that time, and I saw some community people get engaged at that time. They were cleaning up vacant lots and things like that. And I just asked myself, like I asked everybody else, what are we doing individually? So and I don't live in the urban core. I did for years, but I don't live there now. But I was thinking, what can I do to contribute to make it better? And I would go weekly to mow the lawns and, of course, pick up the trash and then help have some other people help me. And that gave me another end to some segments of the community that I didn't regularly deal with because I wasn't in the field as a patrol officer again. So I met a lot of people doing that process, and I still talk to some of those people that I met in 2005 all up until now. Matter of fact, I was on Prospect this morning, and I actually tweeted when an officer had stopped the car. But I still drive through Prospect. I still stop and talk to people because, again, I think that open communication is going to be the key to making our city safer.
Well, speaking of people stepping up as you did with these vacant lots, when we were talking about these two crime situations earlier in the show, you mentioned that the crimes themselves are maybe less unusual than we'd like them to be, but was people coming forward the way they did, was that unusual?
No, we have that all the time. You know, we have that, but we don't get a lot of publicity because, again, when someone comes forward, you don't want to come out and say someone's name. I can tell you a quick example just this Sunday. I got a call when I was in the office, just happened to be there Sunday, where we had a person doing some things in the neighborhood, and I'll give you a little bit. I can't go in a lot of detail, but about purses being stolen from some of these businesses. You know, they had the young lady's picture on television, had a name, and expressed that we were looking for her. I got a call Sunday and told us where some of the property was, sent officers out there. They were able to recover some of the property. Things like that, and that's not unusual. A lot of us have people to talk to us on a regular basis, but we can't come out and talk about the names and specifics on it because those people may not talk to us again. But this, I can share that with you because this person said, I don't care if you say my name because this is wrong and I want to get involved.
Do you think then that it's a perception thing, this whole idea that there's this really prevalent, like, no snitch rule that you hear about?
It's out there. But I think a lot of oftentimes in the media it's hyped up a lot because look at the tips hotline. People are getting paid on a monthly basis to provide information, and they're providing information. They get thousands of tips a year, help us solve many crimes. So it's out there. We need more people to give us information, though. But again, I put a lot of things back on the police department. We have to make it safe for people to do that. We just can't say, tell us something, and then we move on down the road. We got to build those relationships where people trust us. And I talk about trust all the time, and I get beat up for talking about trust.
Who beats you up for talking about trust?
Some media. I don't want to talk about the media, but some media saying Forte stands up and he's talking about trust. But, you know, I think that's important. We have to know the customers, our customers. I know we're not profit-based, but you know what? There's a lot of people out there losing their lives. They don't get involved until they are directly impacted. Then they, you know, a lot of them want to get involved in reducing crime. But I'm asking everybody, before you become a victim, before you know of a victim or a victim's family, get involved now because we have a great city. I travel around the police conferences several times a year, and I can tell you about some of these cities that are totally, truly out of control. And Kansas City is truly a safe place. I know we hear in the paper today or yesterday where we had five people shot and one killed this weekend. But you know what? It's happening everywhere else, but we're not as bad as a lot of places, but we're not as good as we need to be either.
You mentioned that Kansas City is a safe place, and I'm curious about how you evaluate the safety of a place. I mean, how do you measure that?
But if you look at our violent crime, that's I tell you this, I'll back up when I first became chief. You know, I submitted a plan to the Board of Police Commissioners, a strategic plan, and I mentioned in there hotspot policing because over 50% of our homicides occurred in less than a 13-square-mile area of Kansas City. So you look at the other over 300 square miles of Kansas City, a relatively safe place to live. You know, and you look at those, most of our crimes are concentrated in our poor neighborhoods, our neighborhoods where there's educational opportunities is not taken advantage of, underemployment, unemployment. So you can basically predict. We don't need a computer software to tell us where the crimes are probably going to be. We can tell you from some of the socioeconomic conditions and things like that where we've had problems and we'll continue to have problems.
So Kansas City is a safe place unless you live in a few very specific areas. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, it's still safe in some of those areas. A lot of times it's lifestyle. You know, we have very few random homicides. Most homicides, the victim and the suspect are known to each other. And oftentimes they are close associates at one time. So if you're not involved in a high-risk lifestyle, your chances of becoming a homicide victim in Kansas City are slim.
So you mentioned that you're trying to build trust and make it safe for people to come forward with information. What are some of the ways you earn that trust? How do you make it safe to deliver tips?
Some of the things we do when we have community forums, we have community forums regularly. We'll have several this year where we invite the public in. What we've done this year so far, invited some groups in to tell us what they want, what their perception of crime, you know, versus us getting the microphone, standing on the stage, you know, sharing numbers with everyone and talking about what we're going to do. We're inviting the community in to share what their perceptions are, what their needs are, and how they can contribute to help us versus us being the ones with the mic and sharing what we do. And commanders have to go out in the field now. It's not just the trust building on the outside of the police department. Our commanders that are not assigned to a field division, they have to go out four times a year and mingle with our officers. Because, you know, in the years before this, there was no requirement. If you were transferred inside, captain, major, deputy chief, or chief, there was no requirement to go back out and mingle with anyone. So if you get an assignment in a financial services division, guess what? You have to go out there at least four times. Some people go out more than that now, but it wasn't required. So we want to build trust internally and externally also. You talk about just me tweeting and other social media for our police department. We're reaching out to people. We're trying to share what we do, and we want them to share with us what they do. And one thing you'll see, my command staff, we don't blame the school district. We don't blame the city council. We don't blame the mayor. We don't blame parents. We in this thing together, and we just have to figure out what we're going to do to make it better, because we don't have enough time to blame everybody else because we have our own issues internally.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Chief of Police for Kansas City, Missouri, Daryl Forte, about some recent incidents that sparked community responses where the public was really mobilized in helping the police department to solve some crimes. And Daryl Forte, I want to go back to those incidents. Can you tell us the story of the highway shootings, just what was going on in case people need a refresher?
Well, we knew early on that we had some pretty strong leads. We had a suspect who was later identified driving up and down the highway, taking random shots at people. He struck a few people, none critically. We had a great team come together, FBI, ATF, Blue Springs, Lee Summit, and other agencies. We met every day for at least an hour or so. And some days there were over 60 people in the room. And we're just brainstorming and doing some things that we need to do. Numerous leads came in on a daily basis, and we were happy with that. We immediately wanted to make the community feel safe, but we placed officers all up on the highway, all over the areas out south and other places. We had marked cars, unmarked cars, and many of us, and this is the kind of police force you have, many of us rode up and down the highways ourselves even when we wasn't on duty.
Did you do that?
Yes, I did. I did it on a regular basis on my motorcycle and in the police car on a regular basis. I just hoping I could find something or be there when something happened. And I wasn't the only one, because I noticed other people out there as I was traveling up and down the highway, because they looked suspicious too, because sometimes it wasn't a lot of cars and you're thinking, well, that car went by already. You know, things like
it
that.
It was a fellow police officer.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the kind of police personnel we have in Kansas City. We weren't getting paid for. We weren't doing to get attention. We just drove up and down the highway. And I came out publicly and said this. I told my mom it was still safe to travel up and down the highways because she lives in that area.
Yeah, at the press conference after an arrest was made, you said you told Kansas Cityans that they were safe driving through Kansas City. They were safe on our highways. For any highway, that's a pretty bold assertion. Did anyone give you trouble about that?
None at all. None at all. I think they felt the safeness, and they tweeted about the safeness. They sent letters in about the safeness, because if they saw a police car every quarter mile or so, it made them feel safe. It made them feel safe.
Well, it was very shortly after the spate of highway shootings that there was another high-profile case that mobilized a community. This was a shooting at a gas station at 45th and Cleveland. Could you recap that incident for our listeners? It's really a sad story.
Yes, it was two juveniles in the vehicle and the driver of the vehicle who was ultimately killed by the suspect who basically ambushed them. I can't think of the young man's age that was actually critically injured, but
I think he was in his 30s.
Yeah, I believe he was. And he lived around the corner from there, had been raised around the corner from there. I made that scene, and a lot of family members there. That's probably one of the larger scenes where we had so many people that were active for his family members and friends, because he'd been in that area for probably most of his adult life. And the other juvenile in the vehicle wasn't injured, but that garnered a lot of sympathy and support from the community, because that young man was shot and killed, and the little child was hurt.
There was a vigil at the gas station that lots of people attended. Reports say about 250 people were there. Were you there?
No, that was on a Monday. I was out there that Sunday. I do a lot of things where the media is not there because I just don't want to do it for media attention. But I was actually after that Sunday for 4 hours talking to people at that gas station, and the vigil occurred the next day.
What did the people tell you at the gas station when you went, and are you able to say?
Yeah, they told me what they heard and what the deal was. And some of it was accurate. You know, when we found out later on that day, of course, we didn't know if it was accurate. But some of the information that they gave me about what the relationship between the victim and the suspect was, and, you know, some other things that were happening in the neighborhood. And what surprised me, I have family members that still live in that area. So many people remembered me from when I was a kid over in there. I went to the Boys Club up the street from there for years and years ago. My uncle and cousin still live around the corner from there. I mean, just so many. And I had another uncle live two or three houses up from the gas station before he passed away. So it just, you know, a lot of people there, a few people I went to high school with, and I didn't go to high school there. I came out of Ruskin High School, but they drove by. I mean, just different people. And some people were just curious to see the scene, but I stopped and talked to a lot of people out there, and they did have some useful information.
I want to get more into your background shortly, but back to the vigil for now. From what I've read, it sounds like a gathering of prayer and shared grief quickly transformed into a rally against people staying quiet when something has happened, and instead encouraging people to share what they know with the police. And in fact, the grandfather whose grandson was paralyzed in this incident spoke up saying, "Where's the village?" What is your interpretation of that question? What do you think this grieving man meant?
I think what are we going to do as a community to step up and step out? You know, I've talked to the grandfather. I talked to him even before this. You know, they business owners in the community. And again, I think it's important for those relationships. Nobody blame the police in this. You know, oftentimes you've seen over the years, the police get the blame if we don't solve something or if something happens. I think that mindset is moving away from what it used to be, because we don't get the blame for a lot of things. And again, I think that's why it's important that I'm out there, and I'm tired a lot of times, and we got a lot of people on my staff. We're out there talking to people and sharing the true message. We're tweeting. We're going to a lot of community meetings. We're just showing up at different places so they can see that we care. We had our first homicide victim family forum about 2 years ago, and we had one last year also, where the homicide detectives actually meet and mass in a location around town, and they actually talk to the homicide victim's family. And so many comments from these families saying, "I didn't know they cared that much. I didn't know they couldn't sleep because this wasn't solved." And I just think us coming together. So when he talks about a village, I think he's referring to everybody coming together and everybody having a part in making this work.
Who called that vigil? Who organized it?
I don't know. It was several people that put things out. And then I like to share, too, that there was a lot of people that was at the vigil that failed to be vocal, that was walking around in the neighborhood, even that Sunday when I was parked out there. There's some people out there when there was no cameras out there, there was nothing else. They were walking around in the neighborhood, knocking on doors, passing out flyers and things like that. But again, there's a lot of people in Kansas City. Some don't want attention. They just want to go out there and do the right thing, and they'll be out there even before the cameras and everything's out there.
What do you recommend to those people? I mean, is the course of action that this particular group followed what you would recommend?
And I'd say everybody do what's in your heart to do, whether it's vigils, whether it's phone calls, whether it's putting something out on Facebook, whether it's just prayer, whatever you want to do. Because, again, all of it, again, when you talk about a village, is what you're good at and what you're comfortable with. Do that.
People do express fear of retaliation. What do police do to protect witnesses against retaliation? If that's what's preventing people from speaking, maybe knowing that would be significant.
We've done a few things and basically educate people. There's very few cases of retaliation. Very few cases. If you come forward and you put that person in jail, oftentimes all it takes is one person to speak up, and then a number of other people will speak up. We just need one person in a lot of incidents to show that courage. And if it feels like to some people out there that it'll make a difference, they'll step up. And some people are doing it. They're not worried about retaliation. They're not worried about a reward. They're worried about getting this person out of their neighborhood.
Kansas City, Missouri Chief of Police Daryl Forte, I want to know a little bit more about you. You've hinted at some things so far in the show, but where did you grow up?
I grew up, I was born, I believe, when I looked at my birth certificate. I'll go back that far. When I look at my birth certificate on 30-something Street, I think it was Mungall or Askew or something. I just happened to be looking at it a couple months ago. And I lived all over the city. We moved around a lot when I was young. We moved outside the city to South Kansas City at the end of my sixth grade year. I went to Smith Hale Junior High. I went to Ruskin.
I don't want to date you, but when are we talking about?
You're talking about probably middle 70s when I moved out of the urban core then to go to Smith Hale. And I graduated from Ruskin in 1980. Raised by a single parent, raised five of us by ourselves. Never lived in a house with a man. We never went on welfare. I didn't know we didn't have money until I was grown. You know, I was in my 20s and my mom worked at AT&T and she said we probably could have got reduced lunch with having five kids and one parent, but she worked hard, two jobs oftentimes. And you know, she taught us to be ourselves. That's one thing I'm proud of. All my siblings, we believe what we believe. We're not worried about what other people think about me. I'm a Christian. And I feel like, and I've felt like this since I was a kid, probably got me in trouble with some people, some worldly people. But I've always felt like this. As long as God on my side, I don't care if you have 100 on your side, I'm still going to be okay. And I feel like that today. I'm going to do and say things respectfully, but I'm not one of those who go along with the group. And I'm defensive sometimes, but I've taught it's okay to be defensive because, you're a man, so you can be defensive. Just be respectful.
You were sworn in as chief of police in October of 2011, at which point you became the first black chief of police for Kansas City. Do you think your race or any other aspect of your background makes a difference in how you approach your job or in how people approach you?
No, I think it's just my personality. I've been driven in whatever I do. I don't sleep a lot. And I constantly thinking about ideals, how to improve things. I don't think race plays a big deal, at least not in my mind. I want to be the best chief ever. That's what I want to leave. I want to make this police department, and I know it's trite expression, better than what it was when I got here. And I have a great team around me. You have a great board of police commissioners. Get along with city council. I mean, we don't have that riff. Again, but I talked about earlier, you'll never hear me blaming anybody for anything. You know, we're in this thing together, and we need to work together. We might not see eye to eye every day, but we can actually walk hand in hand with no problems because it's about the community, not us individually.
Something people say about you is that you have a really personal, authentic connection with the communities you protect, more than might be typical of a police chief or how we imagine a police chief. Could you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Kansas City and its neighborhoods, how you keep attention on what's going on the ground?
I think just being born and raised here and understanding our customers. There's nothing I had to come in to do. What I'm doing now is not unique to what I've done throughout my career. I remember being a young officer typing up cards and leaving them on some of the church doors at the faith-based institutions, introducing myself, saying, hey, my name is Daryl Forte. I work the night shift over here, and this is part of my area. If I can ever help you, please give me a call. And then I remember as a captain in the homicide unit, family members were coming in. They were grieving and wanted to know what they could do. I remember personally paying for pamphlets and door hangers to hand to them to say, this is what you can do. Go back in that area and pass these things out. So what I'm doing now is not unique to what I've done throughout my career. I just have to keep being true to myself and doing what I think is right.
What are some of the things that you are doing now? You mentioned driving along the highways during the highway shootings on your own in your time off duty. But I've also heard a rumor, and maybe this is just urban legend, that sometimes you drive your car to a neighborhood and just observe what's going on. Is that the case?
I do that on a regular basis. But you learn so much by just sitting back watching. And, anybody around me know I like to talk a lot. I like sharing things with people. But what I've learned probably in the last couple of years, I just listen to a lot of things. I just listen. You know, I just go places and I just listen as people come by and they recognize me and they just talk about things and they share their heart and things. I just like talking to people. And you know what? I really say this and I believe this. I think being the police chief is probably the best job in Kansas City. I don't know what the other jobs are, but just based on what I know and the feeling that I get every morning when I wake up and the way I feel at night, I think I have the best job because I know we're going to make a difference. I know we're going to make a difference, and we're making a difference slowly. And I say we, it's not just me because it takes a team. But I'm at the right place at the right time, and I'm going to take advantage of it to make Kansas City safer and save some lives, save some property and things like that.
You've mentioned earlier that you don't sleep a lot, and it occurs to me, I mean, in my little job as a talk show host, I occasionally get stressed out and lose a little sleep just thinking about something that's been left undone, whatever's waiting for me to still be done. It's just natural. And I can't imagine how a person could manage the stress of being ultimately responsible for, say, reducing the homicide rate of an entire city. And add to that an approach that includes this kind of on-the-ground, humanitarian, human face on things kind of approach. How do you maintain that attitude? I mean, how do you sleep at night?
I believe my background with my mom, you know, raising us not to worry about a lot of things and know that there's a God. I pray every day. I pray throughout the day. My grandmother's 91 years old. I talk to her on a regular basis, and she always say, baby, just keep praying. I don't care what's happening out there. I don't miss sleep because I'm worried about anything. I miss sleep because my mind is just constantly going. You know, I have my iPad next to me, so when I wake up, I'm taking notes. I have pen and paper in the car so I can write as I'm driving. I don't look down, but I can write as I'm driving on this big tablet that I have. I don't know. I think just my energy level, and I've been like that since I've been a kid. It doesn't take a, now I'm 52, I need at least 5 hours sleep. I don't always get it, but if I get 5 hours sleep, I can run all day hard.
Oh, man, good for you. That makes one of us in this room. Shifting gears a little bit, I'd like to ask you some questions that have been raised by some of the newsroom's recent reporting here at KCUR. We had a community listening session in the historic Northeast a few weeks back, and one of the pressing issues for that neighborhood was police response time. The sense seemed to be that the only thing that gets a swift police response is a shooting, and people expressed frustration that break-ins and other nonviolent crimes aren't being treated with urgency. At least that's their perception. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we have the prioritize. You know, when you talk about a priority one call, you talk about sexual assault in progress. You talk about a aggravated assault where a firearm is being used, or a robbery in progress where a firearm is being used. You know, we have to prioritize. There's only so many police officers in Kansas City. And I think we have to do a better job. Not think. I know we have to do a better job of educating the public on these things about if you have a burglary and there's no one there. And, you know, you're already inside your house and you know that there's no immediate danger. It may take up to a few hours or so before a police officer arrives. And I understand the victim, they're wanting an immediate response. But I think we have to do a better job of sharing some of the other things that are going on in Kansas City so they won't be disappointed by those high expectations.
Well, speaking of educating people, what can residents do when they're experiencing something and they can't get a quick police response time? I mean, short of taking matters into their own hands and going kind of vigilante, which I assume is what everyone would consider less than ideal.
But you talk about a vigilante situation, that means there's an immediate threat probably. So, and we would, that would be a priority one call if there's an immediate threat. But if you talk about someone stole your radio out of your car, or your purse was taken from your office or something like that, that's not going to be an immediate threat. So depending on our workload at that time, it may be a delayed response.
We heard stories of people who had very, I would say, unintimidating appearances, who did not particularly seem athletic, chasing people who had broken into their houses all the way home. Is that a recommended course of action?
No, I think, you know, when you start doing things like that, if you're not trained, you know, oftentimes, what are you going to do when you catch someone? You know, if you're not, even if you're athletic and you catch someone and there's two people that you apprehend, I said, let the police handle it. Don't, you know, just use common sense. Use common sense.
This idea of letting the police handle it, though, I mean, I obviously understand what you're saying here, but someone who has just broken into your house does seem very threatening when you're in that situation. And if there's a police response time that doesn't correspond to the urgency you feel, what do you recommend?
Well, if the person, you know, again, if they broke in and they're not there at the time, I understand. I've been broken into before. I totally understand that emotion. And it took them a while to get to my house as a young police officer. But again, we have to do a better job of educating people to let them know if there's no immediate threat, it may be a delayed in response. If your television's gone, you know, and someone's getting robbed or sexually assaulted, we're going to make that call first. It is, you know, and again, we have to do a better job of educating people on why we do that. And there's a lot of emotion involved when you become a victim of a crime.
How much of the police force's energy is consumed by violent crime?
I want to say probably most of it, because, you know, you have your field officers out there, and that's our large contingent of police officers in the patrol bureau office. There's probably about 800 police officers when you count traffic and other things assigned to that element. So a lot of it, you know, it's violent crime. But again, you look at these small parts, and I say violent crime counting small disturbances, because they can turn into a violent crime. So we can't treat anything lightly. But domestic violence, stealing, where the suspect is still there and the victim wants to do something, vigilante type, things like that. So a lot of our time is devoted to avoiding violent crime, I should say.
I'm interested in that. What do you think is the role of the police force in preventing crimes from taking place in the first place? Is that equally attention getting as just finding the bad guys after something's happened?
Prevention is the preferred course of action. And that's why you talk about building trust. When you look at the system, when you talk about the ShotSpotter system that was funded through some funding from KCATA, the Metro.
What is that? Can you explain it?
It's a gunshot detection system. You know, they when a fire a round is fired, the system narrows it down within so many feet of where it was fired, and we dispatch officers over there.
Where is it installed?
We keeping that a secret. We don't want everybody to know exactly where it is. It's about installed 3.55 square miles of Kansas City, and that's where we had a lot of our violent crime, and we had that system installed there. But when you talk about those kind of things, and you talk about officers responding traditionally where we didn't respond because people came I want to say they ignored gunshots in their neighborhood because they happen so frequently. We show up now and we build those relationships with those people in the community. And that's one of the benefits of having a system like that, because now people know we care and they get involved before something happens. So now when we go and to get on the prevention piece, to talk a little bit more about that, and when they know we care and we're responsive, they're willing to call now to say, hey, this car's been sitting out here for a little while. And we've arrived at some locations where people were using drugs in the car, where they were casing some places, because people got involved. In prevention is better than any other piece of what we do, because we need people to step forward to prevent some of these things before they wreak havoc in our neighborhoods.
Would something like a car sitting outside qualify as one of those things that merits a fast response time, or is that one of the slow response time things in that kind of triage?
No, it could be, depending on circumstances. If somebody said there's a car out there and there's two people in the car fighting and they saw a weapon, that would require a quick response. If someone calls and say, I've lived in this neighborhood for 2 months and this car's been sitting out there, I don't know what they're doing, can you have somebody come by and check it out? No, that wouldn't be a priority right there.
You were just talking about some new technologies, and Kansas City's police force has gotten a lot of attention for its use of social media. It turns out the police department is very social online.
Yes, we have a great staff. Again, I tweet at Chief Forte. I try to put as much as I can out there. I think that's important, even when you talk about on the plaza and things like that. It dispels a lot of those things. When you talk about, and since I have the opportunity, I'll talk about it. When you talk about the plaza, it can be two 13-year-old girls fighting on the plaza, and then you look at the media the next day, and it's a junior riot. You know, so I go down there and I tweet about the 13-year-old girls fighting, and it's not such a big deal because we don't need that negative image on Kansas City.
Well, I want to talk to you about the plaza very shortly, but I've been sort of enjoying looking at your Pinterest board, helping people to identify popular street drugs. You've got pictures of all kinds of things up there, ranging from a demonstration, a finger pointing toward what crack looks like, to a photo of a young man drinking hand sanitizer. How do you think that an effort like this helps protect Kansas City and keep it safe?
I think a lot of times you talk to people out there that's not involved in a lot of these things. They don't know. So, again, education. We throw as much as we can out there to the parents and other people so they'll understand when they see something in their young child's bedroom or something like that. We just got to continue to educate people and use as many avenues as we can to do that, to reach as many people as we can.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Chief of Police Daryl Forte. We'll be right back after a break, and at that point we'll be taking your calls for your Chief of Police, 816-235-2888. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman in Kansas City. We've got your Chief of Police in the studio. Do you have a question for him? Now is your chance. Call 816-235-2888 to speak with Daryl Forte. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. The number again, 816-235-2888. And I'd like to resume a conversation that we got started just a little bit before the break about the plaza and the curfew. How, in your estimation, is the curfew working? It's been a few years.
I believe it's working. When you talk about some of the incidents, we made 10 apprehensions this past weekend, Saturday night. But, you know, we don't have the crowds down there, 150, 200, like we had before the 9 o'clock curfew was established this summer.
Those crowds of 150, 200, I understand that people were very intimidated by those crowds. But a question that kind of comes up is, where are kids supposed to gather and hang out? I think back on teenage years and wonder what it would have been like to feel like I couldn't congregate in public places as a teenager.
They can congregate. We don't have a problem with people congregating, but congregate and obey the laws. You know, you don't need to fight, push people in fountains and things like that. And we're not telling people not to come to the plaza. We're telling people come to the plaza and other areas of the city and behave. And I think it was probably a message that was turned around by some people out there. We're saying don't come to the plaza. We're not saying don't come. We're saying come and enjoy it and behave as you're there.
How do you enforce the curfew?
Well, what we're doing, we're not doing strict enforcement or zero tolerance. Some kids just didn't know. We passed out literature this past weekend because some people were saying, well, I didn't know. And I understand everybody's not going to know, but and we make excuses for our kids saying the curfew is difficult to remember. Kids remember everything else. I mean, if they get a job down the road, we shouldn't dumb it down for people. If they get a job down the road and they say come in at 2 today and 4 tomorrow and 6 the next day, put it in your phone. Get a magnet and put it on the refrigerator. There's different things we need to do to make sure our kids understand when there's rules and regulations, you have to follow them, you know, as a kid and as an adult.
What exactly are the rules and regulations?
Well, we talk about, I know the ones for the weekend entertainment, and that's 9 o'clock. I don't delve down into all the ordinances, the traffic violations, and all those things. But I know on the plaza, you have to be out of the plaza by 9 o'clock. We don't immediately start enforcing at 9 because we know sometimes parents and guardians may run into a little trouble getting there. But if you're still there at 9:30, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and you make a noise, we're going to cite you. And then we'll call the parent or guardian to come pick you up from us.
A recent article in the New York Times gave Kansas City a little bit of attention, noting that Baltimore, for example, is kind of looking at Kansas City as a model for this kind of thing. What do you think Kansas City has done well in this respect, and where do you think we still need improvement? What do you think have been some of the flaws, maybe?
I think we still need improvement. We still need to get the message out there to the parents that what the rules are, and we need to ask parents to be parents. And sometimes the parents, when they come down there, they were dropping the kids off. The kids were pretending to go into the movie theater, and they were coming right back out. But again, and I like to say this about our kids in Kansas City, most of our kids are good. And when you talk about 150, 250 kids being down on the plaza, and you have 5 or 10 that are disruptive, they the ones that get the attention, not the ones that were behaving and things like that.
So your estimation is that like 195 kids are behaving?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, let's talk to Andrea in the south side of Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Hi. I just recently moved back to Kansas City, born and raised here. And I live on the south side over by Slow Park. And what I have noticed is that I see people late at night, I mean, rolling joints on their front porches and, you know, fighting and cussing, talking loud. And my concern is, what is being a busybody and what do I need to call the police about?
That's a great question. What do you think about that, Chief Forte?
You can call the police, and if you're willing to sign a complaint, they can't disturb the police of the peace of a police officer. So if you're willing to sign a complaint, we'll cite them for some of the things that they're doing. But if you're not willing to sign a complaint, we can't go. We can go and tell them that, you know, they shouldn't be doing these things. If they have marijuana, that's a different story. We can arrest them for that. But making noise and swearing outside and things like that, they can't disturb our peace. So if you're willing to sign a complaint, we'd be more than happy to cite them.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to know, because like I said, I've just moved here. I was in Baltimore. I lived there. I've lived all over. I've just left Atlanta. And you know, and I know they have, like, community action, especially, like, in the community. But where are these things? I don't really see anything.
You mean,
I don't
like,
watch television. So.
You mean things organized by the police department? Are there things that you're having trouble finding?
Just, like, community action.
Yeah. Well, how can Andrea get involved in her community's safety?
You can call your division station, and if you over there by, you said, by Swole Park?
Yeah, right off of Cleveland and Gregory.
Call 234-5000 and ask to speak to the division commander at Metro Patrol Division, and they can guide you into the resources, and ask for the community interaction officer, and they can come out and personally meet with you if you want to.
Do you feel like there does need to be better education in general about what is a call to the police? What is a, you know, call to 311? What is, you know, the difference between these things?
And if you're not sure, call the police and we'll guide you in the right direction. You just call 234-5000 if it's not emergency. If it's emergency, dial 911 and we'll guide you in the right direction. It's hard to go by individual incidents without knowing all the particulars. So I'd hate to say one thing and someone say, well, Chief Forte said, don't call on this. But if you have any doubt, call us and we'll get you guided into the right direction.
Chief Forte, another thing that's come up in our reporting within the station is some issues regarding homelessness. And we're wondering if the police department plays a significant role in combating or preventing homelessness, or if that's kind of a separate issue because no crime is being committed, clearly. But
no, we all play a role in that. The police, social services, our local government, we all play a role in that. But, you know, when you talk about homelessness, as you talk to a lot of people out there, not all, but some, I have mental health issues, and we have to do better with our mental health piece because there's no place to take a lot of people. So that's something that I think the community has to come together and work on. It is a police issue also because, again, some of the people out there with mental illness, you know, create problems for us and residents. So all of us have to step up and do something about that.
We also do hear a lot about police as first line of defense in mental health crises at times. How do officers in that position balance sensitivity and compassion with their law enforcement duties?
that's part of our academy training. You know, we have crisis intervention teams and things like that. And what we're going to do probably in the future, what we will do in the future, everyone that goes to the academy will get that training. We have certain officers that receive that training now. Sometimes if you listen to the police radio, if you have that access, they ask for a CIT officer. You know, you need something that's crisis intervention trained to go there, and they can understand with people, empathize with people, and treat them, accordingly, and not just be the rough and we take you to jail and you post bond and you come back out. We go deeper than that. We find services for you if we can, and those things.
This may sound like a silly question, but how scared are police officers in the line of duty? It sounds like a very scary job.
I think, you know, you have to have some fear in you. But, you know, but it's that fear that you overcome, because I talked about this with some staff members this morning. You look at firefighters, someone that run into a burning house. You look at police officers. If someone would fire a shot now, I'm not going to go call 911 and sit back and wait. Our nature, and we're trained from day one, go handle the situation. If someone's firing shots outside or wherever, we run toward the danger versus running away from it. And we're different. You know, we have the same issues everyone else in society. You know, we have people with substance abuse problems. We have people with domestic violence problems. We just started probably 3 or 4 months ago. We completed the training, but every officer had to go through an hour's worth of domestic violence prevention training. Every supervisor and commander needed 2 hours of training. So we can identify those people that are around us that might be having issues. So, again, we're human. We have fear, and we probably don't need to be here if we don't have that fear to keep us safe and to make us vigilant and alert.
What is your sense of how scared civilians are of police officers?
I think, you know, depending on what your relationship is, most people I talk to out there, they respect police officers and they understand the need for police officers. But we've, over time, in law enforcement all over the country, I believe we've abused some of our authority. You know, in some cases, when you look at, and I won't talk about it a lot because everybody don't like to hear it, but you talk about the riots in Kansas City in 1968 when dogs were turned on people, water hoses and things like that. There's still people alive. I was 5 or so when it happened. I remember the news pieces. You know, and those are hard to get out of your head. And again, nothing happened to me, but I saw the people around me. I saw the stores on fire, you know, during that time when I think it was April of 1968. So a lot of us have some baggage. And it's not because we picked it up. It's because somebody gave it to us. And a lot of times, but I tell people, we got to let it go, and we got to learn and figure out how to adapt and overcome and use that to make it better. And that's why I'm vocal about a lot of things. That's why I talk about racism. That's why I talk about racial profiling on the police department, because if it's in housing, banking, sports, education, and every place else, why would it not be in law enforcement? It's hard to prove, but again, we have to talk about it if we're going to improve and get better. So, I don't know. I could talk about that all day. That's on my heart, because, trust. If we don't have trust in the community and confidence in the police and people are afraid of us, we're not going to get anywhere. And that's why it's so important for us to come out of the office. That's why it's so important for us to stop and talk to people. We don't need a bunch of programs, projects, you know, foot beat and a whole bunch of other things. We need to get out and talk to people, get out of our cars. That's foot beat. That's walking the beat. Get out of your car, park on the corner. You don't need a specialized unit. And that's one thing I'm not, as long as I'm here, I'm not putting together a whole lot of specialized units to get a lot of attention. I want results and not just attention.
I think you're striking a chord here, because our phone lines are just lighting up. You're listening to the voice of Chief of Police Daryl Forte. He's the Chief of Police for Kansas City, Missouri. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll get right back to this conversation. If you want to join it, call 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. Chief Forte, you were just talking about fear and versus trust. And I wonder, I would think that maybe some police officers would see a certain amount of fear as valuable, but it sounds like that's not the image you want to project.
No, I think fear, you talking about individual fear of the police officers?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's good. I mean, fear protects you. You know, when you identify a threat, you know, if you're not afraid, something's wrong. I mean, that's human. We're not superhuman. We want to go home every day. We don't want to be injured. And we have a lot of police officers that retire for a number of reasons, you know, because we did run to the scene, or we did were involved in an auto accident. We had 119 police officers killed since the inception of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. So it is a dangerous job.
Let's talk now to Stan in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Stan.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What do you have to share with us?
Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. I just wanted to really give a shout out and a big thanks, as my work is the operations manager with the Main Street Community Improvement District. I work very closely with KCPD's Central Patrol Division, and the major there and his sergeants, and specifically Sergeant John Bryan, are just an excellent command staff and very aware of the needs of our community and the needs, especially the business district and the neighborhoods.
Where is the Central Patrol Division? Where is he talking about?
It's over Linwood Troost area.
And can you talk about that particular division, what their challenges and approaches to those challenges are?
Yeah, they're probably no different than any other division. You know, getting out in the community, Major Sean Wadley, I didn't really know Sean before I promoted him. I heard so many good things about him. But I'm looking for servant-minded commanders. And I've put, if you look at all the division stations, they're servant-minded commanders. There are people out there that's responsive to the needs of the community. Of course, there's issues unique, whether it be theft from autos, auto thefts, homicides. There's issues in individual unique issues in all the patrol divisions. But when you talk about Central Patrol Division, Metro Patrol Division, and East Patrol Division, they're kind of the same. But again, you know, like the gentleman just spoke of, we have great people out there. And most of our compliments when we go out there, most of our conversation is positive when we go out to the community, because they know we care. We can't make everything right, but we're doing the best that we can do on with what we have.
Let's hear from Joe in Midtown. Hi, Joe.
Yes, the chief mentioned some of our youth and others are not taking advantage of educational opportunities that are already in the community. And I was just wondering if he has information about what some other cities are doing.
No, I don't. They're doing, you know, I can tell you when I meet with the 60 major chiefs three times a year, at least three times a year, they're doing a lot of things that we're doing. There's nothing new out there. And what we're trying to push as chiefs of major cities is get the community involved and not rely on the government, whether it be the police or the city government or federal government. What can we do individually, like I talked about early on in the program? It's not looking for everybody else to do something, because when I go out there and talk to people, one of the things I start each community meeting out with is, what are you doing individually to contribute? Again, we all know the issues, but what are we doing individually, whether it's having a reading club on your block, whether it's making sure we raise our kids right, you know, and rather than worrying about what they're doing around the corner. But what are we doing individually? They have programs, reading programs like the mayor's doing here. They have boys club, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. I mean, there's a number of things out there. They have baseball teams. They have football teams. Even if they're not well organized, just people in the neighborhoods. It's just getting those kids involved and letting the kids know that we care about them and we're going to take time to deal with them, not ship them off someplace else to go to the center just to get them out of our hair.
Let's hear from Susan in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Good morning. Chief, I have a question about the hotspot saturation program.
Yes.
About a year ago, I was burglarized. I lost about $30,000 worth in property. I knew who did it, and I had a great deal of circumstantial evidence to prove who did it. However, at the time, the detective in the property unit told me that he did not have time to investigate my crime because he was assigned to hotspot saturation, and all of the resources were focusing on that, and there was nothing left to help people like me. How do you respond to that?
Well, you were given false information. You look at the hotspot police officers, and I'm not doubting you, but when you talk about hotspot police officers that are pulled from different elements to help on the street, they're pulled no more than five times a year to go out on the street. So I don't know where that information came from, because they have vacation and they have other things that they have to do. So hotspot policing probably didn't have a lot to do with that detective not being responsive.
Can you describe what hotspot policing is?
Hotspot policing is where I talked about earlier on, where 50% of our homicides and almost 50% of our aggravated assaults occur in less than a 13 square mile of Kansas City. We have four different pockets that make up that less than 13 square miles, and we put additional resources out there. We didn't move officers in the field, but the officers that are in the inside positions that normally don't come out to patrol, they're assigned to go out there four to five times a year to go out there and just be visible and make sure they can still operate a police vehicle with all the different technology changes in there. And it's not just for hotspot policing to be visible and to develop relationships. It's to make sure they're equipped in case we have a critical incident where we need to remove some resources from inside to bring them out. They have their equipment. They know how to operate a police vehicle, and they know who's out in the field, and we can augment what's in the field to help us with whatever critical incident we might have.
This boots on the ground issue, that's the language you often hear, whether there are enough boots on the ground. Is it affecting people's safety? Do you think that we have a not enough boots on the ground kind of issue?
you know, of course, we can always use more. But what I didn't do in my first 2 years when we talked about the budget cycle, I didn't ask for more police personnel. I wanted to make sure the staff that we had, we were using efficiently and effectively. And I'm at the point now where doing the next budget cycle, I will, because there's some other things that we need to do. To me, you can never have too many, because, again, like we talked about, some of the slow response times to the non-priority calls, we have to do better in that area, and we will. But, again, I think we're at the point now, the next budget cycle, we'll ask for some more people.
Andy writes us on Twitter, how can you know priorities if the dispatch system can't take calls? I called 911 and was placed on hold for 5 minutes.
Because a lot of times, again, it goes back to us. I'm not blaming anyone else. When you're calling about a dog barking and you call 911 and somebody else is trying to get in about an armed robbery, it ties up the whole system. And again, and we're working on that. We got a communication plan we just put together. We have to educate the public. We sold that 911 system years ago to be the cure-all. Now, I don't care if it's a dog barking or a legally parked car. People are tying up the system with 911. So we need to educate people. Do not call 911 if it's not an actual emergency. Call 234-5000, and the switchboard will get you, and they can guide you to the right resource.
Not quite as easy to remember as 911, but I guess that's what the difference between an emergency and non-emergency may be, whether you have time to track back down that number, perhaps.
Yes, and I think, you know, again, 234-5000, if you want to put it in your phone. Most of us have phones. Put it in your phone or some things like that. And again, I'm not blaming them. I'm glad people are sharing that with us. I've heard it before. But sometimes people tie up the system, and I've been on the phone, too, when I'm trying to call in an emergency situation, and then I just actually have to get on the police radio.
What are some other things that people may not know about that the police department is doing?
They may not know the police department is accessible. You know, they have to know we're accessible.
And what are some of the ways in which you are accessible?
You talk about Twitter. You talk about www.kcpd.org. Get on there and learn about us. Learn about us. And if you want to share something about you personally or your organization, call 234-5000, ask for my office. And if you want to come and present something to the police department about some concerns that you might have at a meeting or some things like that, or you want to host a meeting and you want us to come to listen, call 234-5000. And we're trying to learn about our community.
That's it for our show this morning. Chief Forte, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
My pleasure.
That's the chief of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, Daryl Forte. To listen back to today's show or any of our past conversations, visit us online at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tweet us there anytime. Tomorrow, we'll look back on 20 years with the infamous shuttlecocks on the lawn of the Nelson. When they first appeared in 1994, an outcry erupted. But now, love them or hate them, they're symbols of our city. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.